Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Our program today focuses on two developing stories: the combustible election process in Kenya, and the consequences of the death of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. But first, our brief summary of international news. World Watch. Tensions between North Korea and South Korea intensified this week. North Korea is angry about plans by South Korea and the United States to hold joint military exercises. Pyongyang warned it will launch strikes if the drill goes ahead. And South Korea promised strong and swift retaliation against the communist North if it carries out its threat. Today, North Korea increased the rhetoric by threatening a preemptive nuclear strike against the United States and other purported aggressors. That came hours before the UN Security Council was scheduled to vote on a new round of sanctions on North Korea in response to Pyongyang's nuclear tests last month. And with China's backing, the resolution is likely to pass. The United Nations also announced this week that the number of Syrian refugees who have fled the war has reached a new milestone, 1 million. On the ground, Syrian rebels seized 21 United Nations peacekeepers in the Golan Heights and said it would hold them until the Syrian government forces withdraw from a nearby town. That's a setback to efforts by organized rebel forces to get weapons and other military support from Western countries. In a related development, the new U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, ended his 9-country debut tour with a visit to Qatar. The Persian Gulf state's leader has provided weapons to rebels fighting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And he suggested the U.S. is needlessly preoccupied with worries that some arms meant for the rebels might end up in the hands of militants who oppose U.S. interests. Across the Mediterranean and Egypt, a court suspended next month's parliamentary elections. The Supreme Constitutional Court wants time to review new election laws. The ruling deepens Egypt's political uncertainty at a time of social unrest and economic crisis. In Southeast Asia, more than 24 people have been killed during a 3-week confrontation over ancestral rights. Malaysian fighters on Tuesday bombed an armed Filipino group staked out in Borneo and plans to launch a ground assault. The Filipinos claim they're attempting to reclaim land in Malaysia that is rightfully theirs. That's it for World Watch. In Venezuela, Hugo Chavez's supporters paraded his coffin through the streets of Caracas on Wednesday. And the country most affected by life without Chavez may be Cuba, where the communist government declared 3 days of mourning and held a memorial service today. Venezuela's generosity under Chavez helped Cuba survive economically after the collapse of its longtime benefactor, the Soviet Union. And doctors in Cuba helped Chavez survive the cancer that eventually killed him. Mark Frank, an economic correspondent for Reuters, based in Havana, has been filing dispatches on this topic and joins us by telephone from Cuba. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. Well, Mark, what's been the mood in Cuba since the state broadcasters announced Chavez was dead?
Well, you know, today we have, you know, probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Cubans lining up around the country, including here in Havana, to pay their last respects to Chavez. The mood is one of obvious shock. I would say it's somber, mm-hmm. and I would say it's fretful about the future. There's probably no worse news for the Cubans right now than Chavez's death.
Right.
He's played an extraordinary role in helping them get out of the crisis that followed the former Soviet Union's demise. He's played a role politically in helping them become more integrated with the rest of Latin America. He's provided them with cheap oil. He's provided them with billions of dollars in exchange for medical and other services. And he's really helped bring them into the center of the fold after being so isolated for many years. So for the Cubans, Chavez is equal to Che Guevara. Chavez is equal to Fidel.
Right.
They view Chavez as a great revolutionary, and they are obviously extremely upset that he's dead.
Right, and with the U.S. embargo still in place, Cuba depends on Venezuela for most of its oil and nearly half of its foreign trade. So in a worst-case scenario, what would happen if Venezuela's new leadership removes the special treatments?
Well, what I say, which I think is very important, and most experts will say, is that not just Cuba, but all the Caribbean now is dependent on Venezuelan oil. Very simply, oil prices are so high that no small poor country can really survive without help. So Venezuela actually provides the same agreement, basically the same deal to Jamaica, the Dominican Republic. And so all these countries would be in very serious trouble if that, if those, low-priced or well-financed oil shipments stopped. Cuba certainly would be, not just because of the oil like the other countries, but because they also make so much money selling their services to Venezuela. So the result would be devastating. It probably would not be equal to after the fall of the Soviet Union, but it would certainly lead to a very serious economic, if not social and political crisis in Cuba within a matter of months.
Right. And I know you're not an expert on Venezuela politics, but I'm wondering what people there think about the upcoming election. Is there do they think there's a chance that Chavez loyalist Nicolas Maduro will lose?
Well, I mean, I think they do. I think, the Cuban people throughout all their history have faced many, setbacks and many negative events, and they're a bit fatalistic. So even though it's very clear that most of the experts around the world and in Cuba believe that Maduro will win and will win fairly easily, there's a certain amount of skepticism and certainly worry here that he might not. The saying, never say never, definitely applies here in terms of how the Cubans are thinking. And so they're certainly very worried about it. We'll be watching the election very, very closely.
Right. And could these developments help persuade the U.S. government to end its embargo of Cuba?
I would doubt it strongly. There's no evidence at this point that the U.S. will end its sanctions against Cuba until it becomes a multi-party capitalist system. That's been very clearly said by many people in the Obama administration. And so far, there's no indication that Cuba's leadership is willing to go along with those demands. So until that happens, I would doubt very strongly that there would be a lifting of sanctions.
Well, Mark, I think we'll leave it there. And I thank you so much for providing this insight into this international issue.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure. I hope it was helpful.
Okay, thank you. Now, on to the elections in Kenya. 5 years ago, disputes over election results sparked weeks of ethnic violence in the relatively well-developed African country. More than 1,000 people were killed as supporters of rival candidates clashed. This week, Kenya held its first presidential election since the bitter 2007 contest, and the first under a new constitution. More than 70% of the registered voters cast ballots. Everyone is now waiting to see whether Kenya can finish counting its ballots without descending into chaos. Joining us from the capital, Nairobi, is a reporter for Nation Media Group's Business Daily, Wangui Maina. In the studio to talk about the elections is Randy Smith, the endowed chair in business journalism here at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. And he's the author of a book, A Kenyan Journey. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Wangui, so far there have been few politically motivated clashes. The problem this year seems to be technical in nature, a breakdown of the new electronic counting system. So tell us what the latest developments now are with the election.
It's been a long week since Monday. Kenyans came out. We voted. And by Tuesday morning, through an electronic system, we saw results coming in. However, there was a technical hitch as IEBC, the commission in charge, there was a technical hitch and the figures froze. So they opted to go a manual way where all the officers come in and they manually submit the results. As of barely at about 6 o'clock, Uhuru Kenyatta was leading with about 2.7 million. The second competitive guy, who was Raila Odinga, was at 2.1.
Right.
So we're still receiving the results and we see how that goes.
And can you basically describe these two main candidates, who they are?
I would start by saying first, they are sons of seasoned politicians. Their fathers were the first political class after colonialism. I'll start with Uhuru Kenyatta. He's 51 years old. He comes from the biggest tribe, Kikuyu. And Uhuru and his running mate, William Ruto, are currently facing charges at the ICC following the post-election violence that happened the last time we had elections. So they go to court and they're fighting their case, but they put together a team, a coalition, Jubilee Coalition, mm-hmm. and as of the results, they've been the front runners. Then we have Raila Odinga. He was also running in 2007, and he says that he was cheated of victory. Mm-hmm. The 68-year-old is he's a seasoned politician. He's been a member of parliament for Kibera, which holds one of the biggest slums in Africa, for many years. He was detained when we still had the single party system under our second president, who is Moi. And so he's really fought the political battle over the years, and he's hoping this will be his opportunity. His running mate is Kalonzo Musyoka, who the vice president of the country, who was also running in 2007 and came out third. Raila has been serving as the prime minister. He came together with President Mwai Kibaki to form a coalition government that has been in place for the past 5 years. Uhuru Kenyatta has been a deputy prime minister the past 5 years also.
Right. And now today, Odinga's camp is accusing, saying that there's been vote tampering. And I think that the vice presidential candidate is saying that the process should be stopped as legal action is considered.
Yes, that's true. Kalonzo Musyoka called a press conference mid-morning today, and he raised questions about the whole process. He pointed out a couple of issues, things that their coalition, which is known as COD, was not happy with. Some of the things they pointed out was the failure of the electronic system. They said there was evidence that results were being doctored, and he named some constituency where they had questions raised. And one of the things they were saying is that some of the numbers just didn't tally. And he also raised an issue with the refusal of the IEBC, the commission, to allow some of its agents to verify the documents they were reading at Bomas of Kenya. As he raised that, the thing is, as those documents are read from the polling stations, they are signed by party agents. So even as every commissioner stands and reads there, he says that so-and-so of your mm-hmm. party COD ID number signed this. So they, from the polling station, they are signed by party agents. So there's no need, as IEBC says, for them to verify again at Bomas. And then he just... basically, what he said is the county lacks integrity and has to be stopped and start at primary source.
Okay. Let's...
Yeah.
Wangui, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was to explain for our listeners was the fact that not only does the winner have to have over 50%, but there's an interesting breakdown spread around the 47 counties that was set up and designed so that there would be a fair essentially non-tribal. It would essentially be a vote of the people. Can you explain that just a minute, for a minute?
Okay. Yeah. What happened is this is the first election being held under the new constitution. After 2007, Kenyans went and we had a referendum and we have a new constitution. Previously, voting. For you to win, you just needed to have majority votes, and we were divided in provinces, and you just needed a certain percentage. Now, with the new constitution in place, we now have counties, 47 counties. And what the constitution says is the winner must have 50% plus one vote to be declared winner. But on top of that, you must at least have 25% of votes in 24 counties. 24 out of the 47 counties, you must have 25%. So you might have your 50 plus 1, but if you do not have 25% in 24 counties, we would still go into a runoff.
Tell us what it was like for you to vote on Monday. We saw here pictures of long lines. Tell us what it was like in Nairobi, and I know you voted early so that you could get to work to cover this election.
Yes, it was an exciting day. It was the kind of day where people were waking each other up, neighbors, let's come out. And the polling stations were opening at 6 and closing at 5. I got there before 6 o'clock because I had to come to work, and the line was, there were over 100 people in front of me. And patiently, we waited. And being in Nairobi, we have been accused during this whole process, a lot of us, to be the middle-class voting polling station, because we are always on Twitter and Facebook. And you'd see your friends, they're like, I'm at the polling station, I'm waking up to go. Or some will say, I'll go in the afternoon, the lines are long, encouraging people to get out. 5:30, people were already out there. Some are said to have slept on the lines. The polling stations opened, and it was different. Previously, we have always voted with the lines were according to our surname. Mm-hmm. But when we got there, it's according to your first name. That created a little bit of commotion as people were disoriented for a minute. Then we got into our lines, and we stood, and it was camaraderie. It was fun. It was interesting. You talk to people, they told you their stories. The guy in front of me had actually, he works in Afghanistan for an international organization. He had refused to take his official leave days so he can extend it this week so he can fly in to vote. So there was that hold, but it took a while. It took me about 3 hours. And when we got on my queue, the system was working. You put your thumbprint, it showed your face, but you still had to produce your ID. And that ID was marked against a book with your name, your ID number, and also your photo. And then you proceeded with the voting process.
Now, I wanted to also talk about how the media has handled this. I know in the last election, the media was accused of fomenting some of the violence. So along with these the constitutional changes, the efforts to use technology to make sure it's a fair election, the media also had a different approach. Randy, could you explain the difference?
Well, going back to 2007, one of the most popular radio presenters in Nairobi, a fellow named Joshua Rapsang, was accused of essentially sending out hate messages and also a code through his radio program that was coordinating violence. He was eventually indicted by the International Criminal Court. This was a great embarrassment to the media throughout the country, and so they have worked very hard to resurrect their reputation since that time. They've done a couple of different things. One, they've done a tremendous amount of sensitivity training, and conflict training, and also basic journalism training throughout the media, so that words were spoken perhaps in less inflammatory ways. The second thing that they've done, the Media Council of Kenya and the National Cohesion and Integration Commission set up some rules and standards that has kept a watchdog throughout the media and throughout the whole country. And then I'd say the last thing that they did, which was we saw just recently, was that there were two presidential elections that were put together by the media, paid for by the media, and they were really quite good. They really gave the wide variety of the opinion that was out there on the future of the country. It's interesting, as far as the future of the country goes, that you've got the leading candidate right now is also under indictment by the International Criminal Court, and so is his vice presidential candidate. And their trial was scheduled for April, and it's been backed up to August. But it raises the question of what will happen in Kenya should they be elected.
Right. Wangui, let me get your comments on both of those topics. First, the media. How would you compare and contrast the media coverage of this election compared with the one 5 years ago?
I do have to say that this time the media, as much as that individual media houses have come together as one and have one message of peace, if you look at the headlines that came out following the technical hitch, they all spoke of calm. They all told the nation, be calm. IEBC is doing what they have to do. And also, when they came together and they had the presidential debates, they put in their resources, 100 million Kenya shillings in it, and they brought together all the candidates, one platform. The candidates spend most of their time going to rural places, pointing fingers at each other, calling each other names. But at this one point, they stood as equals and they had a conversation from issues ranging from corruption, land issues, because land is a major issue in Kenya. And Uhuru Kenyatta, his family, the Kenyattas, are said to be one of the biggest landowners in the country. And he had to face that, the ICC charges. And that created... Kenyans got to know their leaders outside of them on the campaign trail. And it was good and also exposed us to one of the smaller the leaders we didn't know, the presidential candidate. He's called Dida. He created a sense of he was a sense of comedy, but he asked the simple, what we call Mwananchi, citizen questions. Mm-hmm. So on an issue of corruption, he'd ask, why do you expect a thief to tell you that he stole? So it was nice and it was a good platform. And even beyond your mainstream media, everybody has had one message of keep calm. And right now, even as we as the results are being transmitted and the commission is doing its work, that is the same message across the platform.
Well, I hope that continues. So yes. Speaking of issues, how would you rank them and particularly how this International Criminal Court's indictment played a role in the election. What would you say are the top issues?
I would say land.
Land?
I'd say land, ICC, corruption, and I don't know if you'd put tribe as an issue, but tribe is a major deciding factor for Kenya. It has been. Mm-hmm. And I cannot say that it is this election, but I will also not say that it's not happening. There are people who will vote along tribal, and we are seeing from the results. Uhuru barely gets any votes in Western Kenya, which is predominantly a Luo area, where Raila comes from, and his votes are looking, he's garnering quite the numbers there. And you come to an area like Central Kenya, and Raila is barely getting any votes, but Uhuru has the numbers, is getting the votes. So tribe is an issue in Kenya also.
When do you think we're going to hear some final results on this election? I saw a report, I think, in your paper that there might even be some election results today, but then I'm hearing Friday. But don't they have to have this done by Monday?
They have to have it done by Monday. In the beginning, the commission overpromised. They told us by 48 hours. Well, 48 hours later, we're still here. They allowed 7 days, so by Monday we should have something. Just before I came, Isaac Hassan, the head, he just said that he expects more constituencies to be read. By 6 o'clock, about 130 out of 290 had been read out. And says by tomorrow morning, hopefully, but before the weekend.
Well, let me ask, switch topics just a little bit. And if Kenyatta wins, and he is charged right now with crimes against humanity from the 2007 election violence, post-election violence, what do you see the rest? How will the rest of the world respond to a nation whose president and vice president are essentially under indictment and could be spending a long time at The Hague?
We're not sure what the impact would be. We've had all kinds of that there'd be sanctions happening, that some governments would not want to work with Uhuru Kenyatta and all. But when that conversation broke out, all the nations, especially from the West, their representatives were keen to say, we shall work with whoever is the leader. Right now, Kenya, there's a... as Kenya, reflecting what is happening across Africa, there is people looking east a lot. And there's been conversation that if the West does this, then they'll continue looking east more. But will people work with, if he becomes the president? We are hoping it continues. We hope investors still come to Kenya and that the world would respect what the choice Kenyans have made, because it's a choice that has been made by Kenyans.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today was Mark Frank from Reuters in Cuba, Wangui Maina of the Nation Media Group, and here in the studio was Randy Smith from the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Sravani Pair was the lead producer. Just ahead is Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now Free Press Watch, a segment of Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Chelsea Stewart. This week's news comes from Brazil, Germany, and Mexico. Local Brazilian radio journalist Mafaldo Bereza Goes was shot dead on his way to work February 22nd, approximately 300 kilometers from the provincial capital of Fortaleza. According to CPJ, Goes is the 12th journalist killed in Brazil since 2011. Goes regularly spoke out against drug-related crime in the area, and local police speculate the journalist was targeted specifically for having read the name of suspects stemming from a double homicide in 2012 during one of his broadcasts. Viviana Giacomin, the director of Latin American programs for the press freedom watchdog group, Freedom House, said that Brazil has become one of the worst places in the region for journalists, and local journalists who report on corruption and crime are the most frequent targets of attacks. German parliament passed a law Monday that required news aggregators and search engines to obtain a license before publishing certain excerpts on their sites, reported Tech President. Google wins, freelance journalists lose, the Association of Freelance Journalists reportedly said. The bill will now pass to the upper house of parliament, where social democratic leaders have a chance to block the law. Mexican newspaper El Siglo de Torreón was targeted in its third armed attack in only a week. The first attack took place February 25th when a group of men shot at federal police officers guarding the newspaper's building. The following day, automatic weapons were fired from a car at the building, and most recently, February 27th, a bystander was shot dead, and federal police officer and one other person were injured, reported EFE News. A press release signed by 700 media outlets, part of the informative coverage of the Violence in Mexico Agreement, are demanding more from authorities to guarantee conditions be safe for journalists in the Comarca Lagunera region affected by this violence. For more information on these stories and other events concerning press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Chelsea Stewart. See you next week.